City's News Talk AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Good morning and welcome to your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew. But no justice today.
No justice.
Sans justice. John is under the weather. Not feeling well.
No.
So he's home resting his weary mouth.
His he's had a lot of bad luck with his teeth lately.
He's had a lot of bad luck with his face. Just overall, he's had a lot of facial problems.
He has.
So he's home resting his face. Hopefully, he'll be feeling better later today and back in tomorrow for the Friday roundtable. But we do have a full show for you, a jam-packed show for you today. Of course, I am Drew. That is the lovely, talented, and radiant Samantha, and they're pushing our buttons
this morning.
And we want to hear from you, 651-989-5855, or use the hashtag TCNT. On Twitter throughout the morning, and we will read your tweets and take your calls. We have Max Reimer coming in. I haven't had Max on the show probably since he ran for office, but he's the co-host of a podcast, Kip and Max Save the World, and he's going to come in and hang out with us sometime in the 7 o'clock hour. Senator Dave Osmek will be coming in the 7 o'clock hour as well. Going to a lot of news coming out specifically from the Senate yesterday, but from the legislature overall. The Senate failed to pass the $825 million bonding bill, which I'm not terribly sad about. But the reason that it failed to pass is because you have to have a supermajority, and the Republicans only have like 34 votes. You got to have 41 to pass a bonding bill, and they got zero Democrat support, zero DFL support on it because they didn't think $825 million was enough.
Sounds like enough to me.
They wanted a bonding bill that was much closer to Dayton's $1.5 billion request. So that failed to pass. We'll get Senator Osmek's thoughts on that. Plus the tax bill, the tax conformity bill, the tax reform bill in Minnesota, did finally get through the House, get through the Senate, headed to Dayton's desk. Mark Dayton has promised to veto it, and he's actually planned an event this morning. Let me find the email here.
What, like a veto party?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, he's having a veto party. A great time for my computer to decide to reload. They sent out a media advisory. Members of the press are invited to come watch Mark Dayton veto the tax bill that is going to save Minnesotans a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of confusion. Dayton is going to veto it in front of a bunch of kids.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, let me find the media advisory here.
Yeah, because when I was a kid, I understood I understood vetoes and tax bills and everything. That makes sense.
Yeah, he's going to go to Bruce Vento Elementary School in St. Paul, the governor is.
Why?
Because they have the best building blocks to play with. And that's what the governor likes. Yeah, he's going to go to Bruce Vento Elementary School. He's going to color. He's going to sit on his little carpet square with the kids and play with them for a little bit. And then he's going to visit with students and veto the Republican tax bill at the elementary school. The event is open to the press.
Of course it is.
Yeah, so that's going to happen at 9 o'clock today at Bruce Vento Elementary School.
How bizarre, though. Is that like normal?
No, for
an elementary school?
No.
Is that like?
No.
That's so weird.
It's such a blatant, craven political stunt, you know, to go and get the press and get a bunch of kids. And the reason he says he's vetoing it is because he wants his $138 million in emergency school aid. And without that, he's going to stomp his feet. He's going to throw a tantrum. It's fitting that he's going to be around a bunch of elementary school kids because he's throwing one of his sort of patented Governor Dayton tantrums and saying if he doesn't get what he wants, then all of Minnesota has to suffer.
Well, he'll be around elementary school teachers that all know how to handle children throwing tantrums.
Right, yeah.
So maybe they can help.
Maybe they can put him in the little quiet room.
Where you
calm down, Governor Dayton. Now just sign the bill. Just sign the bill,
just
Governor
chill
Dayton.
Out.
Just relax and sign the bill. Yeah, no, it's this is going to cause, not only is it going to be expensive for Minnesotans, it's going to cause a lot of confusion, a lot of headaches come tax time next year if they can't work this out. Now, they're saying that a lot of the press reports are saying, you know, Republicans have refused to budge on the emergency school funding request. That's not entirely true. Basically, all they said is, we don't have time to do this with this little time left in the session. The session ends on Monday. I mean, everything has to be passed by Sunday at midnight to get to the governor's desk. So we've just literally hours left in the legislative session. He just threw this on the legislator's lap a couple of weeks ago, out of nowhere, just said, boom, we need this $138 million. We need it now. Don't ask questions, just do it. And the Republicans basically said, look, if you want this, you're going to have to call a special session. We've got too much to get done, too much to work on in the final days of the session here. So they clearly indicated that they were open to a special session to deal with this emergency funding. That was not good enough for Governor Dayton. He has no interest. He's done. I mean, you know, his term's wrapping up. He doesn't want to do a special session. That is off the table. So all of Minnesota has to suffer now because Mark Dayton doesn't want to deal with having a special session to get his emergency school funding. After, you know, nearly $1 billion funding increase in education in Minnesota that we've had over the last couple of years. Needs $138 million more, or else you're all going to have to pay a lot more in taxes. So we'll get to that. We'll spend some time on that with Dave Osmick, Max Reimer. We also have Mark Lauder coming on right around 8 o'clock this morning. A lot of news coming out of the Mueller investigation. Basically, Mueller told Giuliani, yeah, we can't indict a sitting president. So I don't know what we're doing here.
We're just kind of, you know.
Yeah. But we can't do it. So we'll get Mark Lauder's thoughts on that. Plus, Vice President Mike Pence expected to play a pretty major role in the midterm elections coming up. We'll get Mark's thoughts on that right around 8 o'clock. But first, Sam has been in there busily scouring the internet, compiling the top 5 stories that you need to be aware of to kick off your Thursday. And we will bring those to you next right here on Justice and Drew.
Justice.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Welcome back to your Thursday edition of Justice and Drew. Sans justice, no peace this morning. Max Reimer from the podcast Kip and Max Save the World will be joining us a little bit later, as will Senator Dave Osmick and Mark Lauder from the RNC. But now, this is the time of the morning when our lovely, talented, and radiant producer has scoured the internet and found the top 5 stories that you need to be aware of before you even dream about starting your Thursday. This is Sam's Top 5.
Number 1.
Rudy Giuliani told Fox News that Mueller told Trump's legal team he will not indict the president.
Yeah, we knew that. I mean, a lot of us that aren't sort of irrational saw this coming, but
right.
Continue.
From the Associated Press, President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, told Fox News on Wednesday that special counsel Robert Mueller has told the president's legal team he will follow Justice Department guidance and not seek an indictment against Trump. Giuliani said this case is essentially over. They're just in denial. Giuliani, who is himself a former federal prosecutor and mayor of New York City, also told Fox News that Mueller's investigators have not responded to 5 information requests from the president's team. That has forced Trump's legal team to push off making a decision about whether the president will sit for an interview with special counsel, a decision they had hoped to reach by today. Giuliani told Fox News about his interactions with Mueller's team, saying, "We've had no response from them. We're asking, what do they really need to know? What kind of assurances do we have that they'll get it over with quickly, just like they did for Hillary Clinton?"
Yeah, you compare this investigation to the investigation into Hillary Clinton's, you know, email problems, email server, and the breaches that happened there, and it's just laughable, you know, the intensity and the focus and fury that has gone into this investigation. And I get it. You know, I mean, to an extent, I get it, because we do want to know the extent to which Russia attempted to meddle and in some instances did successfully meddle with our election. But this investigation has at least on its surface has appeared to be much, much less about that and much, much more about Trump, trying to find anything they can with Trump, Trump and his campaign, members of his campaign, anything they can to look for, you know, some head to roll on this, and less about actually, you know, looking into Russia's attempts to meddle, what they did, what we can do to prevent it in the future.
The precedent that federal prosecutors cannot indict a sitting president is laid out in a 1999 Justice Department memo. Giuliani told Fox News that Mueller has no choice but to follow its guidance. Giuliani joined Trump's legal team last month and has repeatedly warned that an in-person interview of the president by the special counsel's team would constitute a perjury trap. Complicating some matters, Trump himself has refused to rule out agreeing to an interview with Mueller.
Well, I don't blame him.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, there's been no indication from the Mueller camp that the, you know, the Trump administration and campaign officials have not cooperated.
Yeah.
You know, there's been no complaint about a lack of cooperation, you know, not providing the information that is requested. But yeah, I kind of agree with Giuliani that at this point, like, if this had happened 7 or 8 months ago and Mueller had said, you know, I want to sit down with the president, I want to ask some questions, I might have had a different take. But at this point now, it's gone on so long. And it has expanded so far beyond looking into the specific, you know, Russian attempts to influence, meddle, you know, whatever, that, yeah, if I were the president, if I were on the president's team, I would give him the same exact advice. Don't bother, because chances are they are just looking, you know, to get you to say something that contradicts a tweet that was sent out, you know, sometime over the course of the last year.
They're looking for a gotcha moment.
They are.
Number two.
Hamas says most slain Gaza protesters were its members.
What? What? But the media told me they were just peaceful protesters. They're just average civilians peacefully protesting. No, this can't be true.
No.
This has to be fake news.
From the Associated Press, the militant group said yesterday that most of the protesters killed this week by Israeli fire along the border with the Gaza Strip were members of Hamas, an assertion that deepens the starkly different narratives on both sides over the deaths. Israel.
There's the truth.
Right.
Which is that, yes, Hamas was behind all the violence that happened along the border, and that Hamas, you know, historically, repeatedly, has used civilians as shields, has sort of hid themselves amongst groups of civilians but then there's the story that, you know, that a lot of the media likes to run with, and it blows my mind how willing so much media is to sort of go along with basically what amounts to Hamas propaganda.
Israel, which has faced blistering international criticism over its response, is likely to latch on to the remarks to bolster its claims that Hamas has used the weekly border protests as cover for stage attacks.
Yeah, because they have. Hamas is like, that's us. Like, we're doing that. And the media's like, no. Just stop. Seriously, that's us.
And human rights groups say that the identity of slain protesters, including a possible affiliation to a militant group, is apparently irrelevant if they were unarmed and did not pose an immediate threat to the lives of soldiers when they were shot. In an interview
That's Hamas's tactic.
Right.
That's what they do.
Right. In an interview with Baladna TV, which is a private Palestinian news outlet that broadcasts via Facebook, senior Hamas official Salah Bardawil said that 50 out of the nearly 60 protesters killed on Monday were Hamas members, with others being from the people. Bardawil did not elaborate on the nature of their membership in the group, and his claim could not be independently verified.
Why are we questioning it? I mean, he's like taking credit for this.
Yeah, I don't know why there's so much. He's like,
well, hold on, Hamas. You know, we need to look into this. No, that was us. That was our people. Those were people that we told to go attack, and Israel killed them. Hold on. Yeah, we'll have to independently verify that.
It makes no sense. It was unclear if the protesters he was referring to were militants or civilian supporters of the Islamic group, which rules Gaza and opposes Israel's existence. The affiliation may matter little to those who have deemed Israel's response to the protesters to be heavy-handed. For Israel, it was enough to cement its narrative, according to the story. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Emmanuel Nashon said it was clear to Israel, and now it is clear to the whole world, that there was no popular protest. This was an organized mob of terrorists organized by Hamas.
Yeah, and I believe that 100%. And we have enough history to show us that is a tactic that Hamas has used over the years. And it's just, it's really unfortunate and kind of gross, you know, how many people are just perfectly willing to play into the Hamas propaganda. There was a tweet that was sent out earlier. Let me find it here. Well, I'll find
yeah,
it.
We're
up against a break. We will sure. continue with Sam's top five, and I will find there's some more relevant information on this that I found via Twitter a little bit before the show started. You're listening to Justice and Drew on Twin Cities News Talk.
Justin.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Welcome back to Justice and Drew. The phone number, 651-989-5855. You want to take part in the show at any time. We left off talking in the middle of Sam's Top 5, talking about Hamas basically admitting that most of the slain Gaza protesters were its members, were basically taking credit for instigating a lot of the violence that took place along the border when the embassy moved to Jerusalem. This has been a tactic that Hamas has used throughout the years, yet so many out there in the global media seem willing to sort of cover for them and treat it as if it is some peaceful unarmed protest that Israel is just giving a very heavy-handed response to, which is just not the case at all. There was a story in the New York Times that I found earlier this morning, and this indicates, you know, what Hamas does and why the media is oftentimes so willing to go along with it, because, you know, for at least a portion of it, they're simply afraid. There was an excerpt from this opinion piece in the New York Times where they write, "Early in the war, I complied," and this is a journalist writing this, "I complied with Hamas censorship in the form of a threat to one of our Gaza reporters and cut a key detail from an article that Hamas fighters were disguised as civilians and were being counted as civilians in the death toll. The bureau chief later wrote that printing the truth after the threat to the reporter would have meant, quote, jeopardizing his life. Nonetheless, we used that same casualty toll throughout the conflict and never mentioned the manipulation." That's important to keep in mind when you look at, you know, how all the conflicts along the Israeli border and how all the conflicts with Hamas do get covered. I mean, one of the tactics that they use beyond posing as civilians, using civilians as shields, sort of infiltrating themselves into crowds of civilians in order to get as much collateral damage as possible to make Israel look bad, is threats and manipulation of the media that is in that area. They outright threaten the lives of reporters if they report the truth. So that's, you know, something to keep in mind as you digest a lot of this coverage. We did leave off in the middle of Sam's top five. Let's get right back into it.
Number three.
Trump's disclosure of some payments to Cohen have raised a few new legal questions, apparently. And apparently this is,
I think, last time I checked, it was perfectly legal to pay your attorney.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No. Ridiculous. President Donald Trump made no mention in his financial disclosure report yesterday of a $130,000 payment to porn star Stormy Daniels to keep quiet about an alleged affair, but the annual financial disclosure reveals a payment between $100,000 and $250,000, which is a huge window,
right,
to his longtime personal attorney, Michael Cohen. Which apparently means that Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti, says that Trump needs to answer some questions.
"You can't reconcile it with what Michael Cohen previously told the American people earlier this year. You can't reconcile it with what Michael Cohen's attorney repeatedly told the American people earlier this year."
Cohen, apparently.
But you kind of can.
You kind of can.
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going off memory here. Cohen basically said that he initiated these payments. He made these payments. He didn't tell Trump what these payments were for, and then Trump just reimbursed him. So there, it sounds to me like there was sort of a level of don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah.
Going on between Trump and his attorney, and his attorney would handle things and just go to Trump and be like, you know, there's some things that were handled and they cost this much. And Trump said, okay, I will reimburse you that amount.
I'd be curious, and I haven't seen any stories that point this out, but I would be curious to know how much that Trump has paid Cohen in other years.
Right.
Beyond
some context.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like there needs to be some context.
Was this unusual? Was this an unusually high amount?
Right. Right. Yeah. Would this have been a moment of like, well, why do you need $100,000?
Right.
Or is it just like a regular thing? Because to us, that sounds like an insanely large amount of just like large lump sum of money to just go flinging around at nothing. But to Trump, who settles a lot of giant business deals all the time, it might have just been nothing. Cohen, of course, we're referring to the story where Cohen paid porn star Stormy Daniels $130,000 in late 2016 to keep her quiet about an alleged affair with Trump.
Think about this. If he had just paid her more, like we wouldn't be hearing about any of this.
Yeah, 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 pretty
like,
much.
This would not be a story
pretty
if
much.
That number would have just been higher. Because that's really the crux of why Stormy Daniels has been out there.
Yeah.
You know, the don't forget, this whole thing started because she wanted to get out of the non-disclosure agreement, and she wanted more money.
Yeah, and I'm sure that she's making more money in plenty of other ways now. And who knew who Stormy Daniels was before now?
I mean,
some people.
Nope, certainly not me. Never.
Definitely not.
No.
Definitely not. Office of Government Ethics Acting Director David Appel wrote to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein that he considers Trump's payment to Cohen as a payment on a loan and that it was required to be disclosed in Trump's June 2017 disclosure. Ethics experts said that if that was that money was a loan and knowingly and willfully not disclosed, Trump could be in violation of ethics laws, a violation for which others have been prosecuted.
Yeah, I mean that's the extent of it. You know, the only thing they're going to quote get on Trump will be possible campaign finance violations if this was determined to have come out of, you know, some campaign fund that it wasn't supposed to, or you know, some vague ethics violation. But this is, at the end of the day, this is going to amount to a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah.
Number 4.
The Senate has approved a measure protecting net neutrality.
Good job, Senate. Way to go.
You're doing so much.
Such heroes.
A measure protecting net neutrality.
You know, the Senate can't pass a damn thing.
No.
like nothing good, nothing of substance, nothing important can get out of this Senate and get to President Trump's desk, but they can virtue signal on net neutrality at the drop of a dime.
Pretty much, yeah. A measure protecting net neutrality is headed to the House after passage by the Senate yesterday. The vote was 52-47. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer pushed the Democratic measure.
This is our chance,
our best chance,
to make sure the internet stays accessible
and in our control
for all Americans.
And under the thumb of the government.
It's so dramatic.
I know. The internet was doing fine before all these rules went into place, and it will continue to do fine.
The Democratic resolution would reverse the FCC's repeal of Obama-era net neutrality rules that prevent internet service providers from slowing or blocking content on selected websites. The measure preserving...
Which they weren't doing.
Right, which they weren't doing even before Obama saved the day. The measure preserving net neutrality faces a very steep climb in the House.
Yeah, the translation, it's going nowhere.
Yeah.
This is not going to get through. Yeah. I would be shocked if this gets through the House. And even if it does, it's most likely going to be vetoed by the president. It's not necessary. It's grandstanding. It's political theater, by the Senate. This is not necessary. The net neutrality rules were regulations to try to prevent a problem that didn't exist that might, you know, someday somebody might do something. So we're going to pass these rules to make sure they don't. If it does turn out, you know, if I'm wrong and it does turn out that Without these rules, suddenly the ISPs really do start throttling and blocking and censoring and things like that, then by all means, federal government, step in and do something. But don't try to solve a problem that doesn't exist yet.
Well, and the other thing is that if those services start doing those things, I'm sure there's going to be services that don't. So you can choose to not give them your business.
Exactly. There's going to be so much innovation in terms of how we access the internet, how we use the internet within the next 5 years, that this is not going to, you know, these rules are basically already obsolete, but they will be even more so within the next 5 years or so. You see a lot of people pushing for this because they simply, and I don't understand this mindset, they trust the federal government much more than they trust the private enterprise, you know, private businesses, corporations. They feel that corporations are out to do horrible things to them, to treat them horribly. Yeah. And so they would much rather have all these services be provided by the federal government. The push towards net neutrality is part of a larger push to treat internet access like it's some sort of public utility, which I think will be terrible in the long run, but that's where it's going, and I'm not confident that it won't get there.
South Dakota Republican John Thune criticized the Democratic measure.
The resolution offered would impose partisan, onerous, and heavy-handed regulations on the internet.
Mississippi Republican Roger Wicker said the Obama-era net neutrality rules amounted to heavy-handed government regulation.
Almost immediately, we saw a chilling effect on investment and innovation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, he's right.
Yeah.
He's right. The rules are the main impact, the top impact of these rules is that they stifle innovation. And the internet is going to, and technology and the way we access the internet, I mean, it's not going to be long before it's not going to be very long before the idea of having to have your home sort of hardwired to connect to the internet will be more or less obsolete, especially in metro areas. Rural areas, you know, it'll be a bit longer, maybe a lot longer. But, you know, there'll be a time real soon when we're just able to access the internet wirelessly, you know, throughout in metro areas, the same way we get cell coverage.
Yeah.
Number 5.
Governor Mark Dayton has vowed to veto the tax bill, saying schools are his top priority.
Yeah, but now. they weren't a little while ago, and it'll probably change again.
From the Star Tribune, a sense of chaos consumed the state capitol yesterday as lawmakers' two biggest priorities, taxes and an infrastructure bill, both went into the ditch with just a few days remaining in the legislative session, which I believe wraps up Sunday at midnight.
Correct.
Governor Mark Dayton is promising to veto a tax bill that the Republican-controlled Senate passed narrowly yesterday after criticizing GOP legislative leaders for their apparent unwillingness to approve an additional aid package for schools. Meanwhile, a public works infrastructure measure that would have showered hundreds of millions of dollars on roads, bridges, water treatment, and other projects around the state was defeated in the Senate on a party-line vote. The developments and the hard-edge political attacks that accompanied them were the latest burst of partisan dysfunction at the Capitol, where Republican lawmakers have been unable to reach agreement with the second-term DFL governor on any of the major pieces of legislation that lawmakers have been considering since February. The legislative session ends on Monday, well, technically Sunday at midnight, but lawmakers must pass all legislation by Sunday at midnight. I'm sorry, that was redundant. Dayton said of the GOP tax bill, "I'm going to veto it," which would cut tax rates on the two lowest income tiers and align the state tax code with recent federal tax changes. In an interview at the governor's residence, Dayton blasted Republicans for not moving on his school aid request.
Look, if we had a rational governor, you know. I said if we had a rational governor, this tax bill did pass with bipartisan votes. There were DFLers that supported it. Sign it, you know, get it into law, avoid the higher taxes that the Minnesotans are going to have to pay, avoid the confusing mess that Minnesotans are going to have to deal with when filing their state and federal returns and all the differences between them. Avoid that, get it all taken care of, and then call a special session. The Republican leadership in the legislature has already indicated that they would be open to a special session to deal with school funding. So that's how you deal with it. This is not that complicated, and it doesn't need to be this complicated. And it's unfortunate that we have a governor that's going to hold tax relief hostage and is going to punish average Minnesotans because he's throwing a temper tantrum over the very questionable assertion that we need $138 million in emergency school funding. We have Senator Dave Osmek coming in a little bit later on this morning. Plus, Max Reimer is going to join us, I believe, here in the next segment. And we will spend some more time on this. Plus, your calls as well. 651-989-5855. Stellar job, Samantha.
Thank you.
Excellent job on the top five, as always. We'll be back right after this. Justice.